This is part of the long-term conditions module, and we're speaking today about visual impairment. I'm an optician. I work primarily in research now at the university, but I still work in clinical practice as an optom, seeing patients with normal vision with various levels of visual impairment. What we're going to talk about today is, well, I see visual impairment as a long-term condition in itself, so we're going to be looking at some of the main visual problems, main ocular problems that lead to long-term sight loss. We'll also be looking at some of the main general health problems that can have ocular complications and then lead to problems as they progress. So, there are four kind of main aims that I want to reach today. First of all, just to look at vision and understand vision a wee bit better, how it works, and the anatomy that underlies that, and the main kind of visual functions that make up our normal sight. How these are affected by long-term eye conditions and general health conditions, as I said there. The role of the different vision professionals and how you can access them. And then what you as an OT can do in clinical practice. So that's the plan for this morning. So we've got our first lecture now. And then we've got two workshop sessions. There's actually four different stations within that, so we'll do two before coffee and two after coffee. I'll be doing one of those. We've got three visitors coming, one's with us today. I'm more a clinician, so I'm very much more looking at the clinical functions of vision, but I know you're much more rehab professional, so we've got people who are more from the rehab side who are visiting us today, and they'll speak about different things you can do in practice for rehabilitation and low vision aids and things like that. So that's the plan for now. Lecture one is kind of split into four sections, and I'll do about 15 minutes on each of those, starting off with a wee bit of basic anatomy. I'm not a biologist, so it will be basic, and I'll try not to do too much physics. A wee bit about visual functions and the main aspects that make up vision and the main things that can go wrong with those. Look at common visual problems and then the general health conditions. So, if we start off with anatomy, did most of you do biology at higher level? Yeah. So this will be possibly familiar to you, but I'll go through it just kind of layer by layer to remind you of the main parts of the eye and what they do. So working from the left over to the right here, you're starting with the cornea. Cornea is, it's about a centimetre in diameter, so give or take. It's the clear structure that forms the first part of your visual system. All of the structures in the eye are highly specialised to enable the eye to form and to work as an optic piece of equipment, really. It's to focus and to collect the light and then to transmit that back into the brain. The cornea is, like a lot of the structures in the eye, is specialised in that it's completely clear. It's a highly innervated organ. So if you think, if you've ever gotten a piece of grit in your eye, how much that hurts. So you know how many nerve endings there are in the cornea, but they're not visible at all. So unlike the nerve endings within the rest of the body, which are myelinated, which are covered in that white sheath to speed the transmission of impulses, a lot of the nerve fibres within the eye, both in the cornea and in the retina, are not covered in myelin, which means the impulses are slightly slower, but it means that the nerve fibres are clear and light can pass through those. So light is passing through to the retina at the back of the eye. If we just go through them actually one by one. So first of all, you've got the cornea. You've then got the anterior chamber, which is filled with the aqueous humour, or the watery part of the eye. You've got the iris here, you've got your pupil in the centre, you've got the lens, and you've got the ciliary body and the ciliary zonules that change the focus of the lens. You've got the main body of the lens, so the bulk is made up with the vitreous humour, which is the jelly-like part of the eye, and then the external coverings of the eye. The white of the eye, which is called the sclera, which is continuous with the cornea. This forms one whole layer the whole way around, but the structure changes slightly as you get into the cornea. You've then got the choroid, and again this forms a continuous body the whole way around the eye. The choroid teams up with the ciliary body and then into the iris as well. And this is primarily just a really vascular structure. It provides the blood supply to especially the retina. And then the innermost layer is the retina, so that is a sensory layer within the eye. And the retina itself is seen as an outpost of the brain that goes back into the optic nerve and back into to meet up with the rest of the brain and back to the visual pathway, which we'll cover in a wee bit later. Speaking of the functions here, so we've got the aqueous humor. This is derived from this area of the eye, and it's constantly replenished. So it forms at the level of the ciliary zonules. It flows in front of the lens, out through the pupil, into the anterior chamber, and then drains away back out here. And on occasions that will start to block up, so you get a blockage in the drainage channel here, and that leads to an increase in the pressure in the eye, and that's a condition called glaucoma, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. You've got the iris. This is really a muscular structure. It's highly muscular and also highly pigmented. So it forms almost like the camera focus forms the aperture for the eye, increasing and decreasing in size depending on the light levels. You have the lens, which I'm sure most of you know, forms the main focusing power of the eye. You've got the cornea, which is a certain amount of power, bends the light a wee bit. Majority of the focusing comes from the lens. And the bodies here are connected to muscles, which change the focus of the eye by relaxing or contracting the muscles. They either let the lens become fatter, smaller and fatter, which bends the light more, or they pull it up tighter, so it's slightly slimmer and bends the light a wee bit less, depending on whether you're focusing on something far away or something that's closer to. Then the jelly in the centre of the eye really doesn't do an awful lot, except keep the structure of the eye intact. It forms just the bulk, the structure really. The main part to think about when we're thinking of the retina and the structures at the back of the eye is the fovea. Anybody remember what the fovea does? Fovea is part of the sensory part of the retina. So all of this structure, all we see here that's yellow, is collecting light in one way or another and transforming that light into neural impulses. But the way that happens across the retina changes and varies slightly. What happens at the fovea is you have the densest collection of the photoreceptor cells. So this is the most sensitive part of the eye. And if you've any damage to the fovea, then it has a huge impact on your vision. So if we are looking at something, so for example, if I'm looking at the Starbucks coffee cup on the front table, that image passes through my eye and will be focused because I'm looking directly at it. The light will pass through the centre of the eye, be refracted by the lens, and then come back to sit on the fovea because I want to look at that, so I want the light hitting the area of the retina that has the most receptor cells and is therefore the most sensitive and will give me the most visual information. And that then passes back into the optic nerve. Stop and ask questions at any point in time if things are not making sense. So that's the retina, is this yellow layer, that's taking a side slice. If you were in the opticians and they'd taken the photo of the back of your eye, this is what you would look at. Is this picture you've maybe seen before or not at all? Is this a wee bit familiar? Okay, so we'll go through some of the structures relating what you see here to what we saw in the picture before. First place to start, because it's always the most obvious thing to see, is your optic nerve. So this is always kind of circular or almost circular structure, and this is really just a part of the eye where things come in and out. So you've got the blood vessels coming in, you've got, I can't see the colour so well from here, but you've got the lighter and the darker ones. I think that's a lighter one there, which is the artery, and then you've got the veins draining the blood away. You tend to have one central retinal artery, but that then branches into two components, and then it branches and branches and branches again into smaller and smaller blood vessels. They will always serve one half of the eye. So you've got this upper branch which will serve this top half of the eye, and the lower branch which serves the bottom half of the eye. And within the eye there is quite a distinct horizontal line, and we'll see that when we come across and look at glaucoma. The blood vessels form one half of the eye and serve one half of the eye, and also the nerve fibres also come from one half of the eye. So blood vessels come in, but also your nerve fibres, so you have photoreceptor cells are attached then to bipolar and ganglion cells, and those come across the retina and leave the eye and go back into the brain through the optic nerve. Let me see what else. So yeah, the fovea and the macula are the other two things you can see here. Fovea is this part in the very centre of the eye. colour is slightly different because you've got that greater density of the photoreceptor cells. And the fovea is that wee yellow spot you can see in the centre. I can't quite see it here, I think it's just about there. So the fovea is the very, very centre of that area. The zone around it is called the macula. Not quite as sensitive as the fovea, but still the most sensitive part of the eye. And what you'll notice is actually there's very few blood vessels in that area. You've got really big blood vessels and really clear vascular supply in the more peripheral parts of the retina. When you come to the macula, it's again about ensuring you get the maximum reception. So you don't want big blood vessels overlying that part of the eye because it interferes with the light getting through and back to the receptor cells. So, photoreceptors. Maybe remember these from school, or maybe your anatomy in first year. We have two different types of photoreceptor cells in the eye. We've got the cones and the rods, and that's based just on the way they look when you look at them under a microscope. The cones have a slightly more pointed appearance. They do two different jobs within the eye. The cones are the ones that get all the credit for doing the colour vision and the fine vision, but the rods are the ones that are kind of the workhorse of the eye. There's far more of those, and we use them to a huge extent, but the cones are the ones that give us a fine, detailed vision. The cones are the ones we are using at the minute. So in normal, everyday light conditions, we use the cones. There are three of them. They each pick our receptive to a different colour of light. So we've got the reds and the greens and the blues, and that gives us our perception of light. It's not that the cone itself perceives a different colour of light and then transmits that information back. It's that each one will only pick up one colour, and within the brain we then have a comparison of which colours that are being perceived to give us our perception of colour. When it comes to nighttime, we're not using our cones, we're using our rods. Rods either detect light or not light. There's no comparison within the brain between the different colours that are perceived, so we have no perception of colour at nighttime. That's where the difference comes in. And this is then the pathway of light as we're looking at something. Basic optics of the eye, we've got something at distance. The light enters through the clear cornea, through the clear aqueous, passes through the pupil, is bent by the lens, and then is focused on the retina. I'm sure you've heard this before, that things are actually focused upside down, so everything within the eye is back to front. And the processing of that to turn it into the perception of the visual scene that we know and recognise happens within the brain. Those are the intraocular structures, but it's important just to have a wee quick look at the extraocular structures as well. The main one to think about are really just the muscles. So if I want to look at the Starbucks cup, I turn and I move my eyes. If I want to look out the window, I turn and I move my eyes. It's not a head movement, it's an eye movement. And they happen so spontaneously that we don't think about the muscles and the nerves that are involved in that. But you've got six main muscles that are there. The four recti and two obliques. The recti are really easy to see and they're really easy to understand. They sit at the top, bottom, left and right. So your superior rectus, when it moves, it pulls the eye upwards. Your lateral moves the eye outwards. Your medial rectus moves the eye in, and then inferior moves it down. The other two muscles have more of a complex pattern, and they are involved in the rotational movements of the eye. Your inferior oblique comes in underneath the eye and kind of tucks in at an angle of about 50 degrees. When you think of the superior oblique, where it is, that's it there. It's a more unusual one. It comes forward and it tucks into a wee bony outpost here, just in our upper eyebrow, and then comes backwards into the eye. So that shows it a wee bit better. So this is the superior oblique. The rest of them just come in and insert into the eye and pull the eye in the right direction. Superior oblique comes up into that wee hook, comes back, and then goes backwards. So it has a slightly more complex pattern of movement. But then if you think of the visual pathway, again, this is something you've probably seen before. As we said, we've got the retina. The nerve fibers collect the information here and then pass back into the brain. The pathway is, it takes the information to the occiput. So the primary visual processing centre in the brain is at the back of the head. So that information is passing the whole way through the brain. The main thing to know about the visual pathway is what happens in the middle here. The word that we use is semi-decussation. If anybody ever asks you a question, unlikely, about the visual pathway, the answer will probably be something to do with semi-decussation. It's to do with the way that the light or the information about our vision transfers from here back to here. This gives you a wee bit more information. What doesn't happen and what you might expect to happen is that information from the right eye either goes straight back to the right side of the brain into the visual cortex, or that it either goes over to the other side, because we know that if we have a stroke, right hand lesion often leads to left side weakness. So we can understand that they cross over. It's a wee bit more complex than that, in that the information that crosses is not to do with the eye itself, but to do with the area of the visual field that information relates to. So if we think of the green here, which is the right hand side of vision, that comes back, it comes into both eyes and comes into the left hand side of the eye in both cases, because things are reversed. What happens in the information with both eyes though is different. Information with the right visual field that goes into the left eye passes straight back. So it doesn't cross over at all, it goes straight into the optic nerve, to the chiasm, and passes back to your visual cortex. Information from the right visual field that goes into the right eye, however, it crosses over. So it comes to the chiasm, crosses, and then back to the left-hand side of the occiput. We'll come to this when we come to think about stroke. It's not important when you're thinking about the eye, but if you're thinking of damage to the brain that's affected the vision, that's important, because the position of the lesion then will give you information about what area of the vision will be affected. So it's not as simple as a right brain lesion leads to left eye damage, but it's right brain leads to left visual field in both eyes. So that was a basic anatomy, very, very basic anatomy. Any questions? Or we move on to visual function. So visual functions are the type of things that I would measure in day-to-day life as an optician. These are the things you're doing on pretty much every single patient. Your vision, when it works, it just works, and you don't think that it's made up of lots of different components, lots of different visual skills. And I think it's important that if you're thinking as a clinician and either trying to diagnose the problem or trying to provide rehabilitation, that we understand which of the parts of that visual process, which is really quite a complicated process, have broken down, where is the problem, and therefore how do we address it. And I think that this comes from an OT perspective, it doesn't come from an optometry perspective, and I think this is always a really useful way, if we're thinking about vision and we're thinking about what's gone wrong with vision, to think about a hierarchy of visual skills. At the base of that hierarchy, and what forms the foundation for good visual perception, good sight, are your basic visual functions. And those are the things that I'll be covering in most detail today. So your basic visual functions are your visual acuity, your visual field, your eye movements, the things that form a foundation to your sight. But it's important to know that other stuff then happens to that visual information. So your basic visual functions allow that light, allow that information to pass to the occiput, to the primary visual processing centre. But from there, that information then passes forward into the brain, and there's the higher perceptual and higher visual cognitive skills that are required to make use of that information. The next skill that we need is the visual attention. So that's just the ability for us to pay attention to something within our visual field. There's the ability to then recognise or use your memory of it and your visual knowledge to know what something is, where it is. You then integrate that with vision, and you integrate that with your other senses and your other skills. So using your visual information, for example, to drive your motor skills, to move your hands, to move your head. And then it's your adaptation through vision. So it's your ability to then use the information to respond appropriately to your environment. So our focus very much today is on your basic visual functions. And this is when you have an ocular problem, you're thinking mainly of these. If you have a neurological problem, you're thinking of problems higher up within that pyramid. So, first thing we'll start with, can I have a show of hands, who here has had their eyes tested, ever? Well, that's most of you. Grand. So most of you will have your visual acuity tested sometime in the not too distant past. It's a pretty basic test. It measures the smallest level of fine detail that you can detect. It's the thing that as eye care professionals we would measure by far the most frequently. It's the one that gives us the starting point for all our other tests. But it measures only your central vision. So if we're thinking of our ocular anatomy, that your visual acuity really measures your ability, to see the light that passes straight through the eye. So if there's a problem with the fovea, or if there's a problem with the centre of the lens, problem with the centre of the cornea, anything in that central pathway of light can cause a problem with your visual acuity. But anything that affects, say, the periphery of the retina or the periphery of the lens may not affect your visual acuity. So it's a very useful test, but it doesn't tell you everything about the function of the eye. So it's affected by problem of focus. A lot of you are wearing glasses, so you'll know what that is. Just somebody who's short or long-sighted. Loss of clarity of the cornea. So loss of clarity of any of those structures at the front of the eye, disease of the retina, and also neurological conditions. And those are just some of the visual acuity charts that you will see. We're going to do this later in our workshops. They all have a very similar structure. They start with letters that are big and go down and down until they are at a level where you really just can't perceive them. And in the test, you're just asking the person to read as far as they possibly can. This is your typical one that you'll get. This is called a Snellen chart, just after the man who invented it. What you will also have are the charts that have just wee pictures for the kids to use. And if they're not at the stage of being able to say, oh, that's an umbrella, you'll have a wee card and they'll have all the pictures on. Just get the child to point at the one that matches with the picture. This one it's called an illiterate E or a tumbling E, and that's used for folk who either don't know the letters or maybe speak another language or aren't able to verbalise their letters, so if they have an aphasia. And you're just asking them typically just to use their fingers, so they can just point to say which direction the E is going. And for something like this, it's quite good just to guide them along, because it's quite easy to get lost when you're looking at the whole pile of E's. And you just ask them to say which way you feel the E is pointing as a measure of acuity. And then this is a slightly more specialised chart. Just the way the letters are arranged is the same. So the distance between them is at a similar ratio between them. And it's used more for research purposes. But this is the most common one you'll see. And we'll use this one later on. And we've got near visual acuity as well, your ability to read it near. The visual field is the next skill. Again, if you've been to the optician, you might have had this tested. It's the one with the wee flashy lights where you have to click the button. And your visual field is just everything that you can see at any one point in time without moving your head. So you typically think of your visual field as being relating to one eye or the other. So if I cover my left eye, I'm sort of aware of my hand. If I don't move my eye, I'm aware of my hand out here and aware of it down here. But out here, actually, my nose gets in the way. And my visual field is a lot smaller on this side. So if we think of it like this, it's about, if you think of the whole thing as being 360 degrees, it's a wee bit broader out towards the side, about 100 degrees, only about 60 degrees on this side, and then same thing, thinking vertically, your forehead gets in the way when you're thinking of your superior field, so it tends to be that wee bit smaller. But with both eyes together, you can also test it both eyes together, it extends about 180 or about 200 degrees in total is your full visual field. But the sensitivity of that visual field is not uniform. I saw one of you doing it at the back and you're wiggling your own hand. If you do that yourself, you're aware that you can kind of see your fingers wiggling, but you can't see them in the same detail as if your hand was straight in front of you. So just the sensitivity of your visual field forms a shape much like a volcanic island. So when we were at uni, it was always described as an island of vision in a sea of blindness, or a hill of vision in a sea of blindness. And you've very much got a peak in the centre of that. And that peak relates to the fovea. So your density of photoreceptors is highest there, and the sensitivity is highest there. But you still have perception out to the sides. And that perception we sometimes take for granted, but is the peripheral vision is what we use in our mobility and to allow us to navigate in our environment. Visual field assessment, you can either screen to do a very gross screen of somebody's visual field to make sure there's no great big missing areas, and we're going to be practicing that later, or more detailed assessment, that is something that will be done in a clinic or in a more specialised environment. contrast sensitivity. This is one that people often don't know about so well, but it's a really important part of what the eye does and the function that it performs. Visual acuity tests are very much like the letters on this. They're very dark against a white background. They're typically black on white. But the world that we live in is not black on white. It's shades of grey against shades of brown. And when I was walking into work this morning, especially with the snow, you've got even more shades of grey and even less contrast. So that contrast is just the difference in the depth between two things. So it's really those shades of grey. And that is really important in day-to-day life. If you're thinking about making a cup of tea, you'll often have a grey sink and a grey tap and a grey kettle, and your cup might be a white on a grey background. So it's the ability to deal with those different shades of darkness, really. The type of test that we use, again, really is just 50 shades of grey. You're getting the person to read down. The letter size stays the same, so it's not a test of acuity. You know how small they can read. This is just what difference in grey can they perceive. So what's the smallest difference they can perceive? So you just get them to start at the top and read their way down. Most people can get down to somewhere about there. But in certain ocular conditions, that contrast sensitivity will start to decrease, and that has an impact on your day-to-day life. And then the last one is thinking about the eye movements. So we looked at the extraocular muscles, and there's lots of different things that can go wrong with your eye movements, but we'll break them just down into two main types. First one is just keeping the eye in its normal position. So normal position for us is looking straight ahead. And in some cases, people just can't maintain a straight position with both eyes looking straight ahead. What you can have is a strabismus. That's either one eye turning out, as you have with this gentleman here, his left eye is turning out, which is called an exo, turns out. Or you can have an eye that turns in, which is an eso. And I'm sure you've all come across the odd person who you can see very clearly that one eye is not kind of in the same position as the other eye. The other one is nystagmus. That's a much rarer condition. That's where you have one eye that tends to make an involuntary movement. So one eye tends to be stable, but the other eye is making either an oscillation like that, or you'll often see them making just a jerky pendular movement like this. So both eyes are not able to maintain that straightforward position. Second one then is about your eye movements. So can we look across to the side of the room? Can we look up normally? Are our eye movements letting us do that smoothly and with both eyes coordinated? There's lots of reasons for these. The first one to think about is there a nerve palsy? So those extraocular muscles are served by three of the cranial nerves. If you've got a palsy of a cranial nerve, one of those cranial nerves, it will affect your eye movements. The other one then are, so that's a problem with the innervation of the muscles. You can then also get a problem with the control centres within the brain. So you're thinking of then your voluntary control of the movements, and that's either your fast movements or the slow movements, or the movements we used to see at near. Convergence is a skill that we do all the time, but we don't think about, but it's really important. So if I'm looking straight ahead, and then if I turn to look at my notes, my eyes automatically turn inwards. And they do it automatically. We don't think about it. But in some cases, that movement is really quite difficult. And that makes it very difficult for us to focus at near, and very difficult for us to read for any length of time. So moving on to think then about when our vision starts to go wrong. I'm thinking of the main conditions that can cause visual impairment and how they impact on our vision. The main ones that we're going to look at in this section are cataract, macular degeneration and glaucoma, because those are the most frequent conditions affecting our vision. And if you're working in practice, those are the ones you're going to come across most commonly. Most of the conditions we speak about here are age-related conditions. You will see visual impairment in young kids. You have congenital problems, problems that develop in the early years and in the teenage years, but those are a much more specialised area, and those are something you would focus on if you go to work in paediatrics. But I think for now, it's better just to focus on the ones that you're going to see day-to-day in our everyday population. So sight loss, it affects about 2 million people in the UK. Although when you look at the second line, or the second point down, only a fraction of those are actually registered as visually impaired or partially sighted. So you will see people that are registered, but the majority of people who have got something affecting their vision actually aren't registered. They're either not at the level where they come into the category and are eligible for registration, or actually they choose not to be or don't know they can be. So there's lots of people out there who have sight loss that are maybe unaware of it or not receiving the help that they need. And when we think of sight loss, it's really about those that can't be corrected to a normal level with glasses, for example. But just thinking about glasses, I want to speak about this just really, really briefly, because although refractive error or the need for a pair of glasses is not a visual impairment, it is correctable. There's lots of people out there who actually don't have their vision corrected in the way they could do. And I was looking this up for this lecture, and I was really, really surprised that the causes of sight loss, 40% in the UK, are refractive error. I'm not sure if these guys would agree with that number. It seems really high to me. But I think it's worthwhile considering that there are lots of people out there who are not wearing glasses, whose vision could be an awful lot better just with a pair of glasses on. And something to bear in mind, that people are maybe not getting their sight test, they're not wearing the glasses, they're losing the glasses for whatever reason, that I first started often just getting their glasses in place and getting them wearing the right glasses at the right time. And there's a number of barriers to accessing eye care in the UK. This is a survey that was done by the RNIB. There's a lack of awareness about eye health. There's a lot of people always kind of say that vision is their the most important sense. They'll often say that, and there's a fear of blindness, very definitely. But people don't equate that notion of good sight and eye health and the connection that is between those. And people tend to then go for an eye test in the same way they go to their GP. So if there's a problem, they go and get their eyes tested. They don't think of it in the same way you think of a dentist, which is where you go for your regular checkups. And I'm not sure why that is, but it's just an assumption within folk. And I think it's a good thing to be able to get people into going for a regular eye test every 1 year or every 2 years. The cost issue is not such a big thing in Scotland. I'm not sure people are aware of this, but eye tests are free for everybody in Scotland. That is an issue for people where they feel that an eye test is an expense. It's going to result in glasses that are expensive. I'm an optician. I'm aware of that. I'm aware of what people think about going to an optician, because we are. We're surrounded by frames that cost £100, £200, £300, and then you add the lenses. But if you think of an eye test, I'm on my soapbox now, I make no apology. If you think of an eye test as an eye health examination, first and foremost, if you get nothing done except people having a look at the back of your eye and saying your eye's healthy, grand. Brilliant. If you need glasses, fine. If you feel you don't need glasses, that's always your decision. You can walk away. So people should always come knowing that they can say, thank you very much, I'm going to leave now. And hopefully that would get them maybe past some of that barrier of thinking there's always going to be a cost involved. The other thing's about access. Sometimes it's a geographic issue, not so much when you're in Glasgow. Sometimes it's actually a language barrier. So we've got people from ethnic minorities, especially the women, who often need a translator and don't speak English to a level where they feel comfortable coming. That can be a problem as well. But we're thinking about those three main ocular conditions: cataract, macular degeneration, and glaucoma. So cataract, you may have come across, it's really common in the population. You probably had a granny who's had her cataract surgery done. No, your gran, come on in. So it's really just a thickening and a yellowing of the lens. Tends to be slowly progressive and tends to be initially in one eye and then moving on to the other eye. So I'll get you a picture to show that. That's a really dense cataract on the right there. It's very rare to see something like that in the UK. What you'll more typically see as an optician are these tiny wee spokes here. This is just the beginning of a cortical cataract. And if you look at most 70-year-olds, they're going to have a wee bit of that, or they're going to have a wee bit of that. So you just got the faintest haze in the centre of the eye. And that starts to affect vision slightly. Especially as you get on in years. So as we get up to the 85-year-old age group, about 71% of people will have some form of cataract. What that causes is just a general decrease in vision, so that you've got that general blurring of vision. Let me skip forward, actually. That's the picture that we showed earlier. If we're thinking of what happens with a cataract, it's kind of like that. So you've got that general blurring, general loss of focus, loss of clarity, but you also have a slight change in the colours. So our ability, because the lens is yellowing, it affects the lights that the wavelength of the light that gets through to the back of the eye, and therefore the light that we perceive and the image we perceive has a slightly changed colour pattern. So you've got that blurred vision. You've got that decreased contrast sensitivity, so telling a curb from the floor becomes more difficult. Telling one step from the other becomes more difficult because those shades of grey are less clear than before. You'll have a wee bit of glare because you've got that the yellowing of the lens. When the light hits the lens, it starts to scatter, and so the light causes more glare. You have more sensitivity to light, you're changing colour perception, and very occasionally you'll have a wee bit of double vision, but that's pretty rare. Cataract is very treatable. So this is the one condition where it's very common but doesn't tend to lead to long-lasting visual impairment. Cataract treatment, most common treatment carried out by the NHS. It's a day treatment, it takes about 2 hours. The waiting lists are getting pretty bad at the minute. If you're up in the Highlands, you're talking about a year to have a cataract done. So it's really just about getting people assessed and onto that waiting list as soon as they can, because it's very treatable, so just get it treated if it's causing a problem. Let's move on to macular degeneration. Anybody heard about mac degen? Got a hand up if you know anything. So we've got a couple, few people. So macular degeneration is the most common cause of visual impairment and common cause of registration for sight loss in the UK. When we are still looking at people over 85 years old, 75% of the blindness in that group is caused by mac degen. But there's two main types, so it's important to know the difference in the two main types. The majority of people who have mac degen have dry macular degeneration. Again, it's very like cataract. It's a lot like a lot of these ocular conditions. It's slowly progressive. It starts in one eye, wee bit of blurred vision, and progresses over time to be more severe and then also to affect the other eye. In 10% though, it's the wet type of mac degen. Wet mac degen doesn't come from nowhere. You start off with dry mac degen, and then those at the most severe end of dry, a percentage will go on to have the wet mac degen. So I'll just show you some pictures to give you an understanding of what that is. So that's your normal retina. You've got your optic nerve as before. You've got your macula, blood vessels. Macula is looking nice and clear. There's no change. It's looking nice and pink and even. But if you see, can you see the change at the macula there? What we have is a build-up of kind of fatty deposits at the macula. So this is actually pretty, it looks maybe quite severe when you first see it. This is not that uncommon. So you've got, these are called drusen, and they're a sign that the metabolic products, so the macula, because it's got so many photoreceptors, very metabolically active, and it needs to clear away the waste of that metabolism. If it's not cleared away, that starts to build up. So as a person gets older, it's linked to problems with the microvasculature. It's not clearing away those byproducts of metabolism, and they just build up, and you start to see them when you look in the back of the eye. Just as that's a very early stage, and those are just called drusen at that point. As we progress, you're getting onto an early dry mac degen. So you've got more drusen here. You can see far more out, and they're clumping together at the macula, and if I was looking at that patient, you'd be expecting to see some sort of effect on their vision at that stage. Visual acuity would be dropping, and also contrast sensitivity would be dropping, and you'd possibly be seeing a wee bit of glare as well. What you can see here, you've got these kind of whiter areas. You're getting thinning of the retina here, and you can also see just one of the underlying blood vessels much more visible than before, because you're starting to get that breakdown of the retinal structure. And if we move on then to wet mac degen, the wet just simply signifies that there's fluid at the macula. That's all that that means. In this case, what we have is blood. So you've got the ingress of blood from the layer. So it's not from the actual blood vessels within the retina itself. It's from the blood vessels in the choroid that underlie the retina. Those have broken through the base layer of the retina that's been broken down over this period of dry mac degen. You get this fluid at the macula, and that has a huge impact on vision. So the difference between a dry macular degeneration, which is slowly progressive, and a wet mac degen is wet comes on very suddenly. And this is something that a person will have a sudden loss of vision in one eye. This is treatable to a certain extent, but the sooner you get somebody seen, the better. So if we have somebody that says, that calls into the opticians and says, I've just suddenly my vision of my right eye doesn't seem right, that's something we would see on the same day. Because if we see a wet changes at the macula, that would be an urgent referral to the hospital, and we can do something about that. So those are the kind of visual effects. So for macular degeneration, it's that central fine part, so it's your central vision and your fine detailed vision. You'll often find the peripheral retina totally intact, totally undisturbed. Peripheral retina is fine and the vision is fine, but your central vision, your fine vision, is the one that's affected. You have this blurring, you have often distortion where the macula has started to move, and there's just this black spot in the centre of the eye. And that is a very gross kind of approximation of what that looks like. But if you're thinking of, in this case, we're not looking directly at the castle. If you moved your eyes as you naturally would to look at the castle, that black spot would be on the top of the castle. So this spot, this loss of vision, moves with your central, as you move your eyes. So if you're looking at somebody you want to talk to, you'll not see their face. If you're looking to read, the thing that you want to read is directly in the middle of this black lost part of vision. So it's a very debilitating and has a very severe effect on people's ability to see. A lot of what we do about MAC degen is about prevention. Because for dry MAC degen, there's not a lot that we can do just now apart from recommend supplements. So we'll be speaking to people about their smoking, especially heavy smokers are much more likely to get MAC degen, about their exercise, about high blood pressure, making sure that's under control, and also about your diet. What you're really wanting in the diet is antioxidants. So we're thinking of the bright vegetables, the peppers, the curly kales, all of those kind of things, making sure people have a good varied diet. For wet MAC degen, there is treatment available. These are in the form of injections to try and halt the fluid that's at the macula. Those are, yes, they're successful, but the person does need to be caught quite early, and they try to stop further. They can improve vision slightly, but a lot of the treatment is about stopping further deterioration. Glaucoma is the next one. Check where I am for time. Glaucoma is not as easy a one to define as some of the other types of visual impairment. It's not as easy to see if I'm looking in an eye. It's very easy to see a cataract. It's very easy to see when there's drusen at the back of the eye. Macula or glaucoma is harder to detect. What it is really is damage to the optic nerve. So that's the part where those nerve fibres that have picked up the light are passing through to the back of the eye. It used to be said that glaucoma was due to high pressure within the eye. We don't say that anymore. It's linked to high pressure. You do have people that have had high pressure within the eye, don't have glaucoma. On the other side, you have people that have quite low pressure that do have glaucoma. But typically it's linked to a high pressure within the eye. And there's a few risk factors. If somebody has a family history, they're much more likely to have it. If they're over 40, or more likely over 60 or 70, you're thinking of glaucoma. And it's more prevalent in people with either African, Afro-Caribbean or East Asian backgrounds. And especially if somebody's on corticosteroids for a long period of time, especially oral corticosteroids, they're much more at risk from glaucoma. So you have this build-up in pressure. As I said earlier, that's sometimes because this blockage, this drainage channel has been blocked and this fluid isn't able to drain away, pressure builds up, but it's often not as clear cut as that. But you do have this increase in pressure. It presses on the retina in general, but what the main problem is where it's pressing on the optic nerve, and it's causing damage just at the very edges of that optic nerve. So if we see there, this is a distinctly glaucoma disc. This is a pretty normal looking disc. It's kind of pink and kind of normal looking, and it's got a good margin. This one, if you look at the edge, it's kind of ratty and raggedy looking. But the most important thing is the centre here. It's very, very white. It's very, very deep compared to this one. This one's quite flat, but this one you can see it's dropped much further back. It's hard to see in a photo, but if you're looking with both eyes together, you'd see that it's a much, much deeper disc. What that means is you've lost nerve fibres. That's all that means. So this damage at the edge here means that the nerve fibres that are coming in to the optic nerve to go back to the back of the eye are being damaged and being lost. And as they are lost, the optic nerve therefore looks deeper and deeper and deeper because there's less material in there. So to explain then how that affects your vision, we're just going to think about the way the nerve fibres form within the eye or the path they follow in the eye. As I said earlier, there's this horizontal line, and if we think of the optic nerve here, they follow a similar path to the blood vessel, so they kind of come out and around like this. But they kind of come in bundles. We always call them nerve fiber bundles. They come in these wee packages. And an example, you get damage at the optic nerve here, for example. What you'll get is all the nerve fibers within that bundle are then damaged and the vision is affected. So if you have damage here, you'll have a loss of vision in this whole arc. In glaucoma, what you tend to get is these arcs of loss of vision because of the damage of the optic nerve. You'll often find that this area is spared. The center of the vision is not affecting glaucoma until very, very late on. And what you tend to get is a progressive loss of vision. You'll start off with a peripheral, it's called an arcuate, so it's an arc of vision that tends to get bigger. It then tends to affect the bottom as well. And if it progresses and is not treated, the kind of end stage of very, very severe glaucoma would be resulting in tunnel vision. So your central vision typically not affected, but almost total loss of your peripheral vision. And the most important thing to know about glaucoma is it typically does not have symptoms at the early stages. Because you have so many nerve fibers, you can lose a couple and you don't notice, and you lose a few more and you don't notice, particularly because it's in your peripheral vision. And you may not notice that. And because we have two eyes, you have loss. If I have loss of vision here in my right eye, I open my left eye. And actually that's compensated for. So you might have quite severe loss of vision in one eye that's compensated for by the other eye and not noticed. So glaucoma is one that we are quite keen to get that regular routine of eye tests in place for, just so we can monitor for it. So we can take photographs of that optic nerve. If you look at an optic nerve, it sometimes looks a bit funny and you're like, not seen you before, do you just have a bit of a funny looking optic nerve, or do you have an optic nerve that actually there's something wrong with? So it's about getting those tests in regularly. What you will find though, when you have extensive loss of peripheral vision, especially when it's affecting both eyes, it's affecting your mobility and your walking. So it's affecting those skills about navigation, and then impacting on daily life activities and driving, of course. Glaucoma treatment is typically eye drops. If you're seeing elderly patients, you'll come across quite a few who are using these eye drops for glaucoma. They're used frequently, 2, 3, 4 times a day. It's important just to know that it's important people do keep on using these. It's kind of like when people have high blood pressure and the doctor tells them to take the medication, but they don't think it does anything, so they stop taking it. And it's hard to convince people that this is something is doing anything because they can't feel it doing anything. And also the drops sometimes can cause a bit of ocular irritation. They're known to cause kind of irritation and changes to the eyelids. So if people are having problems, it's worthwhile. Number one, it's stressing the importance of the drops, but also maybe getting them back to the ophthalmologist and saying, oh, this one's not working. Is there something that might maybe cause a wee bit less irritation? The main treatment is eye drops. Occasionally they'll go on to surgery if that's not working so well. And yeah, so we're almost on time. The last thing to pass on to then is thinking of these long-term general health conditions and the effect that these can have on the eyes. I'm not sure, what are you covering any of these in the rest of your lectures as long-term conditions in themselves? Are you doing diabetes as a lecture or stroke as a lecture? No, okay. Just to know what background you have. I'm sure you're aware of diabetes. And that the numbers are increasing hugely, and that at the minute it's about between 4 to 5 million people. Again, it's one that's not always diagnosed promptly. The majority are type 2 diabetes, with only 10% being type 1 diabetes. The difference being the problem with insulin. Is it an insulin resistance problem, or is it a problem with the production of insulin in the pancreas itself? So the majority are type 2. Diabetic eye disease can affect both types of diabetes of both types, but it's linked primarily to two things: the duration of your diabetes and your blood sugar control. So therefore, because people with type 1 diabetes tend to be diagnosed in their childhood or early teenage years, they tend to have diabetes for a lot longer. Often control at the start maybe isn't brilliant, or they have periods where control's not so good, so they're much more likely to have some sort of diabetic eye disease. Although the bigger numbers are type 2, they tend not to have so severe diabetic eye disease. It's also linked to if you have high blood pressure, and if it's a lady who's had diabetes when she's pregnant, she's also more prone to getting eye problems later on. What's a useful wee indicator is if a patient also is having other problems from their diabetes, so things that are signs of the microvasculature being damaged elsewhere in the body. So I'd always tend to ask my patients, so have you had your feet checked, and were you having any problems, or are you having any problems with your kidneys? if they're showing signs of small vessel disease elsewhere in the body, you're kind of more at the lookout thinking, well, if the blood vessels elsewhere are affected, there's a good chance you're maybe going to see blood vessel changes within the eye itself, leading on to problems. Diabetic eye disease covers a lot of different things. Diabetics are more prone to glaucoma, they're also more prone to cataract. But there's two kind of specific ones we think of, which is retinopathy, which is just changes within the blood vessels and the structure of the eye itself. Like most things, they start with small changes and they progress. This is somebody who's at the worst possible stage. You tend to start off with wee things like exudates, almost like drusen. You get deposits of material within the body. And you will get cotton wool spots because they do look quite fluffy within the retina itself. When you start to get a bit more worried is when you're starting to get hemorrhages or leakage from the vessels and these wee microaneurysms. What is a sign of proliferative? So the worst kind of retinopathy is when you're starting to see new vessels grow within the eye. New vessels grow because the retina is not getting enough oxygen. And the eye, as a bit of a response to that, sends out these vascular growth factors which produce these wee vessels, trying to increase the perfusion, increase the blood flow to the retina to try and get those nerve fibres getting enough oxygen to work. But these new vessels are not of the same caliber. They're not as good as the original vessels that grow when you're a child. These are very small, they're very fragile, and they're prone to breaking and leakage. So we're always concerned when we see any abnormal blood vessels, because you're thinking in the next stage you're going to get a bleed into the eye, inside the eye itself, which is not good. The other thing to show you then is diabetic maculopathy. So macula is that area, that central area. Maculopathy tends to be fluid within the macula, which is really, really hard to see on a photo. It's really hard to see in a patient, never mind in a photo. So what I'm giving you here is a scan of the eye. What we're starting to do more and more is actually, instead of just looking flat on the eye, but take scans through so we can see what's happening within the different layers of the retina. This is a normal macula. You can see all the layers of the retina and everything is looking nice and flat and in place. And you've got a wee dip here where the macula would be. This one you can very clearly see where you've got a wee bit of edema. You've got the swelling, which is pretty much undetectable on the photo. I would struggle to see that. Looking at the patient, just looking at the retina. But when you see that, you can very clearly see that there's a swelling of the macula there that needs to be addressed and needs to have to be treated. Depending on the type of diabetic eye disease, very much depends on the effect. If you're thinking of retinopathy, you can have these exudates, you can have these hemorrhages, you can have these effects anywhere within the peripheral retina. So you can't really predict the pattern that's going to have it, but it tends to be patches of peripheral loss of vision. If you're also then talking about maculopathy, where the macula is becoming raised off the bed of the eye, you're also going to get that central loss of vision. So those are the main problems there. It's also worth knowing diabetics also can have fluctuations in their vision. As the blood sugar levels go up and down, it affects the lens swells and lessens again as the blood sugar levels change. So if somebody has fluctuating blood sugar, they'll also have fluctuating levels of vision. And it's not a lot you would do glasses-wise, but you'd want to make sure that the blood sugar is being better controlled to monitor that, to get rid of that. And just one other thing I want to talk about in terms of treatment. In most cases, treatment has an improving effect on vision, but in diabetes you need to be aware of one thing, which is called photocoagulation. Where we have large areas of retina that is hypoxic, that is not perfused, what they will often do is actually do a lot of wee laser scars. I often think these look like just like wee cigarette burns. That's essentially what you're doing. You're putting lots of wee burns across the areas of retina that are not working well. That is in effect to stop them producing that factor that stimulates the new blood vessels to grow. So it's really to kill off the cells in that area of the retina. But if you kill off the cells, yes, it stops these new blood vessels growing, but it also affects the vision. So if you have somebody who has quite extensive photocoagulation done, their peripheral vision starts to be affected. The hospital is usually quite good at monitoring that, especially if somebody's driving. They will monitor that to make sure they're still within the standard. But just to be aware, somebody might be getting treatment for diabetic eye disease, and you're thinking, oh, that's great, they're getting treatment, that will help. Yes, but in this case, you have to be aware that also has implications for the peripheral vision. I'm going to think about stroke. Stroke is my own area of research. It's something that we don't always associate with vision loss. We think of stroke, we think of maybe the fast campaign, you think of the face and the arm and the speech. But long term, we think about 20% of people also have visual impairment, although the figures are variable. They're very variable. What you also find with stroke and vision loss, maybe there's less of an awareness that that can be a problem, both within clinicians, within the stroke team and community teams, but also within patients themselves. They're maybe not always aware that they have this visual loss because of all the other things that are going on and the cognitive changes that happen. Stroke, because it is neurological vision loss, it can happen anywhere along that visual pathway. So there is quite a range of effects you can see. I'm just going to talk about the main ones. So it's not damage. Typically, when you think of stroke, you're not thinking of damage within the eye itself. You think of damage within the brain and the visual pathway. And the main thing you think of with visual, with stroke and vision loss is visual field loss. So if you think of the visual pathway we talked about earlier, when we think of stroke, we're tending to think of lesions that happen number 5, 6, 7, 8. So it's in this slightly further back part of the brain. And because of the way those are organised, the fibres are organised, you will tend then to get loss in one half of the visual field. So it's not right brain, left eye, it's right brain and left visual field in both eyes. So the size varies. The most common is this loss of half of the visual field, but you will get people that lose a quarter, people that lose maybe even just a wee segment. They vary in size from person to person. If you're thinking of something like this, they will lose perception of half of visual space on both sides. So they're essentially kind of blind to one side of space, which is something a bit like that. But the other one they think of is visual spatial neglect. Is that something you've come across before? Yeah. So neglect is where your visual perception is, your visual function is intact. So you have a full visual field, but the processing of that visual information higher up in the brain is affected. So you can't see it, but you're not able to pay attention to it. So what neglect is called is a failure to orient or attend to a stimuli. So it tends to happen with right brain damage, and you'll get left visual neglect, and what happens is people will be unaware of things happening on the left-hand side, although clinically, when you test their visual skills, they should be able to see that because their visual field is intact. A typical test for that is a drawing test. You'd ask somebody to perhaps draw a clock, and they will draw something like that. So they kind of come to a halfway point and are unable to kind of cope with that at the left-hand side. And another test you'll get, this is, I'm not sure what language, not English, you do get an English version with letter E's. This one, the person is asked to cross out all of the small stars, and this person has pretty severe neglect because they're only managing not even all of the ones on the right half, which you would expect them to get. Because you tend to get left neglect, they're not even managing all of those, and they're making mistakes as well. So something like that has pretty severe inattention or pretty severe unawareness of their left-hand side. Visual neglect and visual field loss often look very, very, very similar because they both affect one side of space, and the person has a problem with it with items and with paying attention to one side of space. Neglect tends to be much more difficult to treat because it is a lack of awareness. So it's very difficult to provide rehab for somebody who has lack of awareness, lack of insight of the problem that they're suffering from. It can be very tricky. And then we have these eye movement disorders, as we spoke about earlier. So you have a turn of the eye or a problem moving the eye. This one, like glaucoma, like a lot of neurological visual impairment, patients often won't present with symptoms. Normally, if you have an eye movement problem, especially a severe eye movement problem, that's really disabling. If you have an eye turning this way, you have two different images coming into the brain. Brain does not like that. It is really, really disabling. It's very difficult to walk and make you quite dizzy. And you'd expect somebody to say that something was wrong. You will often find in stroke patients that they maybe have a very gross, very obvious eye movement problem, but will not mention a thing about it. Not entirely sure why, but it's good to know that they may not provide symptoms. So often if I see somebody with macular degeneration or with cataract, you'll ask them, so how's your vision? And they'll say, oh, a film of vision's not as good. Somebody with stroke will maybe not get that reporting of problems. So you just need to be aware there might be something going on that they're not maybe able to communicate with you. So it's about looking at the eyes and looking at the signs that are there. And the last one we're going to come on to, Katie asked me to speak about dementia specifically because I think this is maybe forming part of your coursework or maybe something you're focusing on. And it wasn't something I had actually paid much attention to myself, so it was a bit of a learning experience for me about dementia. I'm sure you're very aware of the symptoms if you've been covering this in your module. Main ones I always think of as memory loss and the behaviour changes, but the one we want to think about here is about your perception. It's about sight loss, and it's about this issue of hallucinations and when is it a cognitive change and actually when is it a visual perceptual change. And I think that can be a very difficult thing to determine. So the main dementias you're thinking of in terms of visual impairment are the ones with Lewy bodies, your PCA, Alzheimer's and your vascular dementia. And if we think of the diagram I gave you earlier where I said that we were primarily going to be looking at your basic visual functions, actually when you're thinking of Alzheimer's and with dementia, you're thinking of your higher visual problems. Yes, the patients seem to be older, so they will likely maybe have a bit of cataract and may have glaucoma as well. But the problems due to the dementia typically tend to be more about their visual perceptual skills. So it's about the recognition of the objects, the ability to use that information effectively. And these, from what I could read, these are the main things that people will tend to present with. So difficulty with detecting movement, leading to bumps and falls and problems with mobility. You have a problem with recognition. So it's either with people misinterpreting what they see or not recognizing, not being able to put a name on what they see. And another one is visual clutter. The fancy name for that is simultagnosia. So people cannot, so an environment like this desk at the minute, people would find very, very difficult to work with. So somebody like that, you would be trying to get rid of all the extraneous, you're getting rid of all the equipment, you're getting rid of everything that's not necessary. And they can deal much more easily with an environment that's as clear as possible. So visual clutter and is very difficult to deal with. So that will present with possibly with confusion, with restlessness. People find it difficult to position themselves. So sitting on a chair, sitting on a sofa, if it's busy, if there's a busy pattern, might be difficult. And with just locating objects. So to me, these would be very difficult as an optician. I would struggle to know the difference between what is a cognitive issue and what is a visual perceptual issue. But I think it's important to know that it may not be a cognitive issue, maybe about your perception of visual space and visual clutter that's causing the problems. So that is the end of lecture number one.